So first of all, is the fan too much on people, or maybe the windows open is too much with the noise? We'll see how the noise goes. We can always close them. If it gets too difficult to hear me, certainly let me know. We'll either close the windows or I'll try to raise my voice more. So welcome again. This is the fourth of the main classes on Chapter 9. This is the fifth class in this course, but again, that first class we sort of caught up. Actually, John, we can pass it back to John. John can use that. Last time we made it up, I think, to about, let me look at my notes, it was right around verse 9.8a, the very first line of that. So in your text that you have, again, the verses are all listed on, at least for the section that we're in, on page 222 and 223. And then we were actually, I think, a ways down on 223. So what I wanted to do first to begin with is just make sure, again, because one of the problems with the way that they've put this text together is that we don't really know what part of the commentary applies to what part of the verses. And I gave that to some people at the very end, but maybe what I'll do is go through the rest of this section right now so that everyone can mark that in their text. And then we can go ahead and go proceed with the commentary. So again, this section that we're on now, that's 9, that we just did at the end of the last class 2 weeks ago, was verse 7, the last line, so 7d and 8a, and that was where it says, objection, this contradicts that the compounded, and so on. It's like towards the bottom of 223, the second section up. The very next section that starts with, objection, this contradicts the explanation that seeing of impermanence, and so on. That's the rest of verse 8, so that's 8, B, C, D, meaning the second, third, and fourth lines. At the top of page 224, that first section there that is an objection and a response, that's verse 9, the first two lines, A and B. Then the next section that is the qualm and the response, this is the rest of 9, so 9, C, D, and the first two lines of 10, so 10AB. And I'll go through these. I mean, I'll make sure I, you know, whereas we're following through that we're relating it to the verse, but I just thought it would be good to go through that now, and you've already got your text marked then. The next section, that's the objection, it is not similar, and so on, is the last parts of 10, so 10CD. Then the next section, the objection and response, if phenomena do not inherently exist, and so on. That's verse 11. The next section, that's the qualm and response, is verse 12. Then the paragraph that says various causes are necessary, and so on, that's the first two lines of 13AB. Then the Sutra School proponents section, though actually I have, we'll talk about it, but I think even a little bit of that paragraph just above it is relating to this verse. But anyway, that paragraph that says Sutra School proponents is the rest of 13 CD and 14 AB. And then the very last thing, the response at the top of page 225, where it says response, there is no fault. That's verses 14 CD and 15 AB. So what I'll do is, before we go into each section, I'll do that for you so that we kind of know ahead of time where things are related. So for now, we can go back to, let me go through this last bit that we dealt with at the very end of the previous class, because I think I was picking up that everybody was pretty full, but I kept going. So I'm not so sure that everybody got the points here. Maybe what we'll do is just begin even a little bit further back with the objection and response, where it says, if forms and so forth do not exist by way of their own character, why are they renowned? And if they are renowned, why are they false? So this objection is related to the first three lines of verse 7. It says, for the sake of engaging mundane beings, the protector taught things. In thusness they are not momentary. So what's going on here is that somebody is raising this this objection Yeah, I think, oh, I'm sorry. That was for verse 6, CD. These objections and responses get too confusing. Okay. So where it says, that what I just read in terms of the objection, and I haven't answered the response yet, but that's related to verse 6, CD, where it says, they are false, just like the unclean and so forth, that are renowned to be clean and so forth. So there's this idea that, again, when we talk about conventional truths in this school, we're talking about them as truths for an ignorant mind. So we know the phenomena, but we know them together with ignorance. We know them arising from this false appearance as having inherent existence. So what's being said here is that after having set out that this is the view of this school, and this is how conventional truths are posited, we're getting some of these sort of objections by various holders of true existence, those who propound that things do have some inherent entity. So this pencil has its own sort of pencilness. By way of that pencilness, it exists. We believe that. This is the ignorance that is at the root of samsara, is misconceiving that things exist by way of their own character, exist from their own side. So what is being objected to here is, you know, how do we then, you know, have things renowned, you know, in the world, so that we know that they are relatively true. Again, conventional truths aren't really truths, but they're relatively true. We all sort of agree that this is referred to as pencil, and we function in that way. But there are questions then, of course, about, you know, how do we know what is true and what isn't? And we have things that are also sort of polluting our mind, other misconceptions about how things exist. So, for example, impermanence. We don't see the subtle impermanence of this. The fact that this object is continually changing moment by moment, disintegrating, is not aware. It's not in our awareness currently, but that doesn't deny that things exist in that way. So we're always sort of trying to find what is the truth of conventionality, but also, of course, the main thing is what is the ultimate truth that underlies all of these phenomena. So in this section in particular, there's just a lot of questions about how that ultimate truth and that conventional truth end up fitting together. How do they relate to each other so that we can then properly assess the way that things exist conventionally, but also understand their ultimate way of existing, their lack, well, through ultimate analysis, what we find that they lack inherent existence, that they don't have any substantial entity. So in this objection, basically saying if they don't exist by way of their character, why are they renowned? If they're renowned, why are they false? So if we'd all agree, for example, that this is a permanent object, that it is not changing moment by moment, why isn't that renowned and true? Whereas it is renowned that this is a pencil. So there's various criteria for what will be renowned in the world and agreed upon as a conventional truth versus a conventional, I don't know if you want to call it a falsity. Again, everything is false at some level, but something that is not proven out in our wisdom, our conventional wisdom. So recall that this whole study of the perfection of wisdom is primarily about ultimate wisdom, about our wisdom that discerns this ultimate nature of reality, the final nature of reality. But it's also clearly understanding conventionalities, how things exist in the conventional world. So the response is basically saying, you know, that there's this same sort of idea that just as we would say that a body is clean after we take a shower or something, we would say, oh, or, you know, I feel so good now that I'm clean. But we don't, when we analyze that, we see that the body isn't in its nature clean. As we said last time, the body naturally, you know, requires bathing after some time. It isn't in a pure nature. So even a misconception that we would have of looking at another body and seeing it in that light, seeing it as something pure or something pleasurable, these are misconceptions that we have in the same way that we misconceive things to be permanent when they're impermanent, or having an inherent nature when they don't have that. In the next section where we see these first three lines that I read a little while ago, for the sake of engaging mundane beings, the protector taught things, in thusness they are not momentary. So someone would object then and say, well, okay, you're saying that things exist momentarily, meaning they're impermanent. And the Buddha taught this. In the very first teaching of the Buddha, the teaching on the Four Noble Truths, one of his main teachings was that all phenomena are impermanent, that this is one of the characteristics of all of the conditioned phenomena of cyclic existence. So this objector is saying, if forms and so forth do not exist inherently, this contradicts the teaching in the sutras that they are impermanent and so forth, meaning that their impermanence is some sort of substantial nature. So once again, people are sort of looking at this and they're assuming that if things don't exist inherently, that it refutes any conventional modes of existence. This is a constant balance that we're going to be dealing with in this chapter, is kind of reconciling the view of a lack of inherent existence with still things having some existence, nominal existence. And you're going to see in the next section when we get into the arguments with this mind-only school that we studied a bit in the tenets course, that this becomes a major bone of contention, is like, what does lacking inherent existence mean? So in this assumption, people are saying that, you know, this objector is saying, well, the Buddha taught that things are impermanent, so that must be their nature. And the response is basically in thusness, meaning when we analyze on an ultimate level and we get to the point of seeing that things lack any inherent nature, there is no impermanence. In the same way, when those of you who you know familiar with the Heart Sutra, when we say there's no form, no feelings, no discrimination, no consciousnesses, and so on, no eyes, no ears, no noses, in the face of emptiness, all these conventionalities cease to exist. So the Buddha's teachings on impermanence and so on, in the very first teaching that he gave, were meant to bring people gradually to a view of emptiness. They weren't the final thought of the Buddha. So we've talked about this before, how these teachings are provisional. They're meant to be interpreted. They certainly resonate within the view of conventional things. You know, and we're going to see in the next section that there's a wisdom even that discerns things as having that impermanent nature. But that impermanent nature isn't their final nature. In the face of this wisdom realizing the lack of inherent existence, there is no emptiness. There is no impermanence. There is no emptiness either, for that matter. There are no conventionalities appearing to this wisdom, and in the face of that wisdom, the way in which conventionalities appear to us and are known is completely refuted. So again, it doesn't deny this very subtle way that things do exist, but it does deny their inherent existence, the misconception that we are, you know, all working with. So any questions on those so far? I realize I'm throwing a lot right in the first few minutes, but we need to sort of get back to speed and try to get through the rest of this section in particular. But
so as far as things being momentary, mm-hmm. I guess it comes down to trying to find momentariness or find impermanence.
Well, there's
saying the inherent existence of it. So.
Yeah, I mean, this is where, again, we have to draw that line between the inherent existence momentariness and mm-hmm. conventionally existent momentariness. You know, what the Buddha is saying in the end is that everything that exists, if we go back to, which will come up later in this chapter, the reasoning of dependent arising. So when we say that things have a mode of existence that is, in its subtlest level, being mere dependent upon mere imputation. So what that means is there is no momentariness that exists from its own side. It only exists through the force of our imputing momentariness to it. But there is a basis for that momentariness. I mean, this is what's the tricky part about it, is that it's not that things don't have any basis. They don't have any inherently existent basis. We never find anything that can stand on its own, that has its own power. So our wisdom realizing emptiness doesn't refute existence completely. It refutes a type of existence, an existence by way of its own entity, from its own side, through its own power. It's a hard one to get. Again, this is going to be the challenge throughout all of our, you know, studies of emptiness in this text and other texts that we study and all of our meditation on emptiness, is finding that razor's edge that allows us to not fall into either extreme. So we've talked about these extremes before. There's the extreme of nihilism, where we refute that there is any existence at all then. You know, so if this lacks inherent existence, then it can't exist at all. That's the tendency that we have to some extent. But more often we fall into the extreme of permanence, kind of holding that things still exist, or eternalism. They exist in a concrete, independent way. Because this is what we are dealing with throughout most of our conceptions and experiences with, you know, phenomena in the world. Okay? Any other questions? So then maybe let's go ahead and read. We did go over this verse, but just this last line of verse 7 and the first line of verse 8, we'll read those together. It's on page 8. I'm sorry, 222. I'm looking at another text here. Page 222, again, the last line of 7, the first line of 8. There is contradiction even conventionally. There is not the fault in yogis' conventionalities. So we see that these two lines are an objection and a response. So someone is objecting. If you look at the commentary, again on page 223, where it says, this contradicts that the compounded are established as being impermanent even conventionally, because things of the morning exist in the evening and so on are renowned as being permanent in the world. So what this person is saying is kind of like, okay, well, you're giving a lot of credence to these observations of how things exist being renowned in the world and then having some validity. As far as I'm concerned, everyone sees this as being a permanent pencil. Why? Because the pencil that I, you know, if I did this 2 weeks ago, held up this pencil, everyone thinks it's the exact same pencil that I'm holding up now. Or if you see that something in the morning, you think it's exactly the same in the evening. We have this misconception that things have a permanent nature, an unchanging nature, that they don't, all these conditioned phenomena don't disintegrate moment by moment. But the reality is that certainly if I were to leave this somewhere and come back and, you know, maybe if I could come back in 50 years, it would look very, very different. It would have decayed to some degree. It would have changed. I mean, we see this even with objects that we have over shorter periods of time that change. Bring home a flower, bring home fruit. You know, how long does it take before it becomes something that's undesirable? You know, so we see that things are changing moment by moment, but we have a misconception that they're permanent. So this objector is saying, well, then if that's renowned in the world, that should be the truth, not that things are impermanent. And so the response is that first line of verse 8, that fault doesn't exist when a yogi observes conventionalities. So this is what I was telling you, is that there is a wisdom consciousness, which is the mind of a yogi in meditation, who does realize a conventional truth, the conventional truth that all conditioned phenomena lack permanence. They are impermanent. They change moment by moment. So everything that arises from causes and conditions, like this pen or pencil, like you know, this cloth, like everything that we deal with in the physical world, all these things are impermanent, changing moment by moment. They don't have any permanent entity. So the response then says, although forms and so forth are renowned as permanent in the world, there's not the fault that impermanence is not established by a valid cognizer. So there's not this fault that refutes impermanence. The fact that we all think it's permanent doesn't make impermanence invalid. Why? Because impermanence and other things, you know, like that are established by the yogi's valid cognizer of conventionalities. So at the very end of that last class 2 weeks ago, I was relating this to our studies when we saw that there are forms of valid direct perception, and one of them is this yogic direct perceiver. And recall that when we studied tenets, we said there was a yogic direct perceiver of selflessness, emptiness, which is the main wisdom that we're trying to realize, but there also is one of impermanence. So there is a yogic direct perception of a conventional truth, of the conventional reality of impermanence. Also, there's a yogic direct perceiver of the ultimate truth, the emptiness, the selflessness of phenomena. But anyway, the point is that when a yogi is in meditative equipoise, they are capable of discerning validly that all of these conditioned things lack permanence, that they are impermanent, changing moment by moment. So this is how impermanence is validly established. Permanence is not validly established through everyone agreeing that it's permanent. In the same way that, you know, going back to the previous verse, the fact that we all agree that our bodies have some sort of nature of cleanliness, or agreeing that, you know, eating an ice cream cone is in the nature of happiness, when in reality we see it's in the nature of suffering or dissatisfaction if we clearly analyze it. So all these teachings go back to, again, the way that the Four Noble Truths were spelled out. They're very much related to the initial teachings of the Buddha that we're getting at, first really clearly discerning how conventionalities exist, eventually leading people to the view of the ultimate truth, the final nature of all phenomena. Is there any questions on that? Is everyone with me so far? Okay, kind of. Okay, let's go on and read together then on page 222 the last three lines of verse 8. That is seeing of thusness relative to mundane beings. Otherwise, their definite understanding of women as unclean would be damaged by mundane beings. So again, this is a continuation of that. If you look on page 223 at the bottom, it says, this contradicts the explanation that seeing of impermanence is the seeing of thusness. So this person is, I guess, again, looking at some of the things that are a part of the teaching on the Four Noble Truths, which seem to indicate that in the Arya's wisdom, in the wisdom of a superior being who is realizing the Four Noble Truths, they are seeing the truth of impermanence. And in that way, they are seeing some truth of thusness, the way things actually exist. And so the very first line of, the second line of verse 8, that is seeing of thusness relative to mundane beings. This is the reply, the beginning of the reply is saying that is only kind of talking about it in a mundane sense, in a conventional sense. Again, this is a provisional teaching to lead beings to the ultimate view. So we first have to, it is said actually that the realization of emptiness is a stepping stone on the realization to, realization of impermanence is a stepping stone on the way to a realization of emptiness. Without having a realization of the subtle impermanence of things, how conditioned phenomena are all changing moment by moment, it's pretty much impossible to view their emptiness, their lack of inherent existence. So this is definitely kind of, you know, a relative to the way in which mundane beings, ordinary beings, cling to things with misconceptions. As I've been saying, they see the impermanent as permanent, they see the impure as pure, they see that in the nature of suffering as being pleasurable and, you know, happiness. All of these are misconceptions that we have. So the Buddha was helping us to skillfully remove those, but leading us to the final misconception that we have, which is that things have a self, have an inherent nature, when in fact they lack that. So what he goes on to say in the rest of that paragraph in terms of the reply is, you know, that this is, if it says, if all that is renowned in the world were to be valid, then it would absurdly follow that the yogi's meditation on ugliness that definitely understands, again, the reason why women is here is not a derogatory towards women, it's because this was an audience of monks that Shantideva was teaching to, and the natural object that they would see as being clean and pure and in the nature of happiness and so on is a woman's body. So you'll see other parts, we've seen them in chapter 8 and other parts of this text where women are used as the example, but it's not to say that a man's body isn't impure as well or unclean. All bodies are unclean. So the meditation on ugliness that definitely understands bodies as unclean would then be damaged by mundane beings who adhere to bodies as clean. So it's kind of like, again, saying at some point we have to decide that there is some level of even conventional wisdom that is superior to our ordinary understanding of how things exist. So again, these things that the Buddha taught by saying that all conditioned things are in the nature of suffering and are impure and, you know, are impermanent and so on, these are all conceptions that he was helping us to overcome our ignorance holding them to be in the nature of happiness or permanent or pure. Our understanding of them as that doesn't invalidate a higher level of understanding that sees them in their real nature, their conventional nature again, not their final nature. So any questions on that?
Although, I guess in one sense, even though he's using the yogis to talk about this, you can even analyze these things on your own and realize that things are occurring and not of the nature of happiness.
And recall that we can have, there's two types of valid cognition. There's two types of, knowing things in a valid way. One is what we were talking about, this direct perception, which this yogi's direct perception in meditation is a part of that. But there's also inferential cognition, which is, when we have a valid conceptual understanding that things lack permanence, that they are changing moment by moment, this is valid knowledge as well. So we don't necessarily have to go to this level. But I think the reason why they go to this level is because it becomes more irrefutable, because then it's not sort of just ordinary beings in conceptual thinking, because somebody could conceive of this, certainly we do, as permanent or as, and so on. So it's not, as you pointed out, it's not to say that we can't also have other valid cognitions of those things. Okay? Let's go on then to the very next section, which pertains to, on page 222, we'll read together the first two lines of verse 9. Merit arises with respect to illusory victors, just as with respect to things. So at the top of 224 is the objection here. The objections are often not in the verses. This is like an implicit objection, somebody kind of saying, well, let me try again. You're telling me that things don't exist inherently. That's contradicting everything that's written in the sutras that says that merit arises with respect to making offerings and the like to the Buddhas, to the victors. So this is kind of somebody who continually is holding to this view that if things don't inherently exist, then they don't exist. So kind of like denying that at some level that we can have a conventionally functioning world when things lack inherent existence. So, most of this section that we're in is really kind of trying to get people past this idea that things can lack true existence, inherent existence, and still function. So in this case, the response is what Shantideva says, there's no contradiction. Merit arises with respect to making offerings to illusory victors lacking true existence, just as one would assert that merit arises with respect to your assertion that the victors exist as true things. Merit arises in concordance with things, whether they're true or untrue. So he's not saying that their view of holding them as truly existent is correct. He's just saying, you hold that these things arise through causes and conditions, that by making offerings to the Buddhas, you accumulate merit and you go on to become a Buddha. This is the way it's taught. That works whether you talk about them being inherently existent or non-inherently existent. We're not refuting causality. We're not refuting the way that functionality occurs in the world. We're refuting the nature of the existence of the elements of that. So there is no inherently existent merit that gives rise to an inherently existent state of Buddhahood. By making inherently existent offerings to an inherently existent Buddha, instead there is only illusory merit that's created through illusory offering to illusory Buddhas that results in your own illusory Buddhahood. Illusory here being like an illusion, and we're going to get into some arguments where this gets to be a sticky point too. People say, well, if it's illusory, then it's just like an illusion and there's no substance to it at all, and you can just negate it. So illusory means it has an illusory nature, meaning it appears to exist in one way, but it actually exists in a very different way. Dreamlike is also used quite frequently, because the objects in our dream are also very similar. They have some substantial entity that, while we're dreaming them, seems to be very real. Upon awaking, though, we recognize that they were just dream objects. They had no substantial reality. And we're not saying that this world is a dream. that, you know, when we wake up, that there was no reality to everything that occurred. It's just the reality of how it occurred and the way it existed is very different from how we conceive it. So it's like we're believing in the dream world to a really great degree. The way that it actually exists is really quite subtle and is not that concrete, not that independent. So any questions on that one? And all of these are just, as I said, in that nature of sort of refuting these misconceptions of what it means to lack true existence. Let's go ahead and read now the last two lines of 9 on page 222 and then the first two of verse 10. If sentient beings are illusory, having died, how are they reborn? For as long as those conditions aggregate, for that long will illusions also arise. So this is where we get into that bone to pick. You know, somebody is saying, and as you see on page 224, that second section, he raises the qualm, if sentient beings are illusory, you know, because this is what you seem to be telling us, Prasangika, you know, you middle way holders, if they are illusory, lacking true existence, then just like an illusion, sentient beings will not arise again after having disintegrated. Having died, how are sentient beings reborn? Again, refuting the whole thing, the whole chain of dependent origination that we've talked about in other teachings, the 12 links of dependent origination that give rise to rebirth and cyclic existence. All of these things that the Buddha taught, they seem to be saying, well, if they're illusory, then just like an illusion, they don't have any existence at all. So we go back to, again, there's this idea of like a magician's illusion is the idea that we would conjure up something that isn't really there at all. You know, that it's purely an illusion. The Buddha's not saying, and you know, Shantideva's not saying that things are an illusion. He's saying they're illusory. It's a big difference when it gets down to it. And you know, maybe what I'll do is read, well, let's go ahead and go through the rest of this commentary and then I'll read a little bit from this. This has got a nice little passage on this section. So the response then from Shantideva is, you know, we're not claiming that illusions and sentient beings are identical in every way. You know, sentient beings are not illusions. Sentient beings are illusory. Rather, we are asserting that they are alike in being and whether they're truly existent or not truly existent. So this is the way that we use this idea of illusory, is that they appear as truly existent, but they lack true existence. That's the illusion that's going on. Just like in our dream, they appear to be real objects, but they really are dream objects. You know, in the end, we don't negate that there were dream objects. We negate that dream objects were real objects. Very big difference between negating that they existed at all and negating that they didn't exist in the way we thought they existed. In case you attribute fault to merely that, then it is tantamount to you yourself saying, since dreams and illusions are asserted to be false, if the basis of a magician's emanation appears as a horse, why does it not appear as a donkey? This is kind of, again, ascribing to things being illusions the power to be able to be whatever you want them to be then. Let me read this passage from here. This is, again, these other commentaries. These are actually the commentaries that His Holiness was using when he did his commentary in France on the chapter 9. He says, I went to the wrong page. I don't want to start reading about mind only. You guys are going to freak out. So he says, the answer to this qualm is given in the two lines that we read earlier from verse 10. Sentient beings are created by karma and negative emotions. As long as negative emotions such as ignorance, which are the cause of the next existence, and motivational factors and so on, which are the karmic conditions, are gathered together, sentient beings will reincarnate and take birth in existence. Furthermore, as long as conditions like the magician's incantations and the various props that the magician uses are brought together, the illusions created by a magician will appear. Without the conditions being assembled, neither of these two, beings or magical illusions, can appear. In taking magical illusions as an example, we are showing that both illusions and sentient beings are alike only in not having true existence, but we are not saying that illusions and beings are alike in all respects. If you consider that in this respect our assertion is faulty, then note that we can apply the same reasoning to your case and say, you also assert that illusions and dreams are unreal, so why can a pebble or a stick used to conjure up a horse or an ox in a magical display produce only a horse and ox and not a dog or a donkey? For in there being illusions, there's no difference whatsoever between them. So it's kind of like, you know, if you're going to start throwing everything in this ball of being illusions, then you're going to be subject to the same consequences, which are that then things don't have any, you know, they can appear as whatever. There's no set quality or identity or entity to anything. So again, this is, again, just the way that Shantideva is trying to get people to see that when they're not holding this view quite correctly and making mistaken assumptions about what that view means, that they're not being logical in the end. And this whole chapter is a lot of reasoning, as you've already seen. I mean, we're just going to continue to get reasons after reasons and refutations of, you know, wrong view after wrong view or misconception or slightly getting it, you know, a little bit off, just so that we can continually keep moving back to this middle way, moving back to this correct view. Yeah, Janice.
Well, it's really useful that it's called the consequence rule for a reason because it calls out the absurd consequences of the other side's reasoning. And I think that's been very helpful for me studying this material in the past.
Exactly.
They use the logic against them. And they're like, well.
And it actually is good to kind of, you know, meditate on these consequences and really see to what extent that your own view of what the Buddha's teachings are on emptiness, which will grow over time, you know, and right now may not feel like it's so complete, but you have some idea, where is it falling and what consequences would result from your misconceptions about what that means. So I think this is really very, very valuable. So that last bit of this section where it says, therefore, also with respect to falsities, for as long as those conditions aggregate, for that long will illusions also arise. That's what was very similar to what was said in that passage I read. Likewise, if the conditions for ignorance and the like aggregate, then minds will also join to future rebirths. So in no way is denying the inherent or true existence of phenomena denying their conditionality, the fact that things rise. Again, because we talked about this reasoning of dependent arising earlier, dependent origination. At the subtlest level, yes, things are only, they're dependent mere upon mere imputation, but that doesn't refute that they're also dependent upon their parts, they're also dependent upon causes and conditions. But those parts and those causes and conditions also lack inherent existence. We're never really getting anything concrete to hold on to, but that doesn't negate that things don't arise. Dependent arising is said to be the king of reasonings because it does allow you to get that middle way where you say they're dependent, meaning that they don't have some independent status, but they're also arising. So they do have something that appears and that is known as a phenomenon and can function as a phenomenon, but it just doesn't have its own independent status. Again, this will get clearer over time, so be patient with your own sort of wading into this. It might feel like you're more than wading, but you know, going into this pool of emptiness and getting familiar with these concepts and what have you. Any other comments or questions on what we covered so far? Okay, let's go ahead and read the last two lines of verse 10 on page 222. Why should sentient beings be truly existent due merely to long continuity? This is a rather strange objection, but maybe, again, we all have these sort of misconceptions that we think that due to the duration of sentient beings, that maybe duration implies inherent existence. And even when we get to, like, the Chittamatra, the mind-only school, they hold the mind to be inherently existent. And mind probably, well, it definitely does have the longest duration of phenomena. Other phenomena probably have similar duration in that we say there's no beginning and no end to consciousness. Our minds have no beginning. They go back infinite lifetimes and they have no end because even when we become a Buddha, we still have mind, we still have consciousness. And the state of Buddhahood is eternal, goes on, you know, forever. So there is this idea that duration implies or can be a factor that leads to some sort of inherent existence. So this objection is saying it is not similar. Why? Because sentient beings are of long continuity since beginningless time. So this idea that duration would be a factor in causing true existence to be there. Shantideva responds saying, why should sentient beings be truly existent due merely to long continuity? It follows that the distinction of falsity due to illusions being of short continuity is untenable. So this is somebody kind of looking at it and saying, you know, you've been talking about illusions, but a magician's illusion, again, this idea that they would take a pebble or something and cast a spell over that and the people watching it and they would all see a horse appear out of the pebble, it doesn't last forever. You know, an illusion will last for some period of time and then it's gone. You know, the illusion's over. But sentient beings have been around since beginningless time. So you're talking about oranges and apples. It's two different things. So this person, Shantideva, is saying, you know, that this distinction of falsity due to illusions being of short continuity is untenable, because in that case one would have to assert distinctions of truth and falsity, since even illusions and dreams are of varying durations. For one can recall an eon, a day, and so forth in dreams. So if we talk about, you know, he's just challenging that even within a dream you might feel like there's plenty of time going by. The duration of the time within a dream doesn't make that dream any more truly existent than a short dream. So in the same way, you know, talking about sentient beings as having had this duration since beginningless lives doesn't really make them any more true in regard to their existence, the mode of their existence. Let's read verse 11 together on 222. An illusion being who kills and the like, who has no negativity because it has no mind. With respect to those who possess illusion minds, merit and negativity arise. What I'd like to do for the question, actually, we'll read it in here, but you know, in the objection that somebody's raising here is saying, if phenomena do not inherently exist and are illusory, this contradicts the explanation that killing sentient beings and the like gives rise to negativity. In your previous translation that we were working with for the other chapters of Stephen Batchelor's, on page 124, he gives a rather more extensive question or opponent's view. He says, nevertheless, if this were the case, meaning if things did lack inherent existence, would not the killing of a sentient being by another sentient being and the killing of an illusory person by another illusory person be equivalent transgressions? By illusory person, he's meaning an illusion. You know, the illusion of a person killing the illusion of a person and the killing of a sentient being by another sentient being, wouldn't they be equal transgressions? You know, if there's lack of inherent existence, then a sentient being killing another sentient being is the same as an illusion of a sentient being killing an illusion of a sentient being. Again, this person is obviously equating illusion with non-existent, with not having anything substantial there at all. I mean, in other words, not having any conventional existence, any mode of existence other than its lack of inherent existence. And would not charity between sentient beings and charity between these illusions of people be equivalent virtues? So this idea, again, is just, you know, somebody holding that those are similar. The response from Shantideva is saying, with respect to the first, you know, when you're talking about killing an illusion being, if there is discrimination as a human being and penetration of the weapon and the like out of the desire to kill, this is what we would call sort of the preparation for an act of killing. So there might be this discrimination that this is a human being that I'm going to kill, that I'm going to, you know, actually do it with this weapon, and I've got a desire to kill that being. There's the negativity of that preparation, but there's no negativity of the actual deed, because we're talking about an illusion being. Maybe it'd be better here to use a dream being. You know, so if you kill something in your dream, I don't know how often this happens to any of you, but if it were to happen to you where you were, you know, seeing somebody who was, maybe they were stalking you and, you know, you killed them in your dream, you'd have that in a sense, the energy of the preparation for it, because you'd have this intention, desire to kill them, and some discrimination of them as a being to kill and so on. But it's not a correct discrimination in the end, because there's an illusion there. There's a dream going on there. It's a dream being. So there's no negativity of the actual deed. So you don't really have a negative karma being accumulated in a dream if you kill a being. Why? Because an illusion being has no mind. So there's a big difference between killing a being in your dream and killing a being in the waking world. In the waking world, we all conventionally agree that an ant crawling on the table or a mosquito landing on our arm has a mind. This is seen by the Buddhas, that these beings have minds. So it's very different than an illusory being in my dream or conjured up by a magician or whatever. Continuing, by benefiting and harming humans and so forth, so this is in regard to the other idea of, you know, having charity towards beings and so on. If you benefit or harm humans and so forth, sentient beings who actually possess illusion minds, illusory minds, then merit and negativity respectively arise. So again, this word illusion is thrown out rather casually. Every time that it says illusion, well, in the beginning when it says illusion, I think it's fine. Here where it says possess illusion minds, I'd almost want to say illusory minds rather than illusion minds. And maybe we'll kind of try to hold that distinction in our class here, is that when we talk about an illusion, we are talking about an illusion. It doesn't really exist even at all as that object in any way. But an illusory thing has this quality of being like an illusion. It is not an illusion, but it's like an illusion. So we all have illusory minds. We are illusory sentient beings with illusory minds, committing illusory actions towards other illusory sentient beings, and we accumulate illusory negative karma that result in illusory suffering. But that doesn't deny that we have the experience, illusory though it may be, of those, you know, consequences of suffering and so on. Sometimes the word even is used illusion-like, but, you know, again, that means that they lack inherent existence. They don't exist in the way that they appear. They appear to inherently exist, but they don't exist that way. Why don't we take a break, and when we come back, we'll continue with verse 12. Have some illusory tea and illusory cookies. So any questions so far? Anything come up during the break?
So when Shanti Day was back, you know, with respect to those who possess illusion minds, merit and negativity arise. I mean, that's, he's saying basically, if you're the type of person who's killing people, you're going to have merit and negativity. Merit and negativity will exist.
Yeah. Basically saying that the lack of inherent existence, or even calling things illusory, doesn't mean that you don't accumulate negative karma from engaging in negative actions. So, you know, this idea that by refuting inherent existence, you're refuting the functionality of karma, is also a misunderstanding of what the refutation of inherent existence means. Yeah. So, I mean, most of this is, yeah, really that extreme of nihilism, of basically saying that there is no conventional world if I negate how that things exist inherently, by declaring their the ultimate truth that they lack inherent existence, I've denied their conventional truth. So it's really going too far in what this negates. It doesn't negate these things occur. It just negates the way in which they exist, which is, you know, if you hold, as we do, that there's inherently existent people engaging in inherently existent actions and accumulating inherently existent karma and so on, that's the misunderstanding. But negating the inherently existent part of it doesn't negate that people engage in actions that create negative karma, all those being nominal and illusory but not non-existent. Okay. Let's read verse 12 together. Again, page 222. Because mantras and so forth lack the ability, mind does not occur. The illusions that arise from various conditions are also various. Or the word there could be diverse. I mean, the idea being that there are many things that arise. So in the commentary on 224, it basically says this qualm, you know, similar in being without inherent existence, why are there productions with and without minds? So this person is maybe kind of finally saying, you know, well, okay, I get that you're saying that the illusion and the people that, you know, are experiencing the illusion are all lacking inherent existence, but why are some productions with minds and some are without minds? So we call a sentient being, you know, with mind, but an illusion of a horse or whatever is without minds. And the response is, you know, because these illusion substances, medicine and mantras and so on, that are used to produce this magician's illusion, they lack the ability to produce an illusion-possessing mind. You know, so it's just not something that can conventionally occur. You know, you can't just conjure up the appearance of a horse and have that horse have a horse mind. You know, it's merely an illusion at that point. It's really just an illusion. So mind does not occur in illusion horses and elephants. The illusions that arise from various conditions also appear in varieties, meaning, you know, again, in diverse ways. The term also indicates that illusions are not limited to sentient beings. So, you know, there are variety of things that are kind of illusory, you know, whether they're with or without mind. These are, again, just the... That's why it's interesting, actually, some of the phrases that are used when we talk about conventional truth and ultimate truth. Oftentimes these are called varieties and modes. So you might see that in some texts. Varieties, because conventional truth is the variety of phenomena. You know, so we... Prasangika embraces that there is a diversity of phenomena. You know, that this is how things come into existence. You plant an apple seed and you get an apple tree that produces apples, and you plant a pear seed and you get a pear tree that produces pears, and, you know, all these things work within the realm of conventionalities, and they work in spite of having this ultimate mode of existence, which is that they lack inherent existence. So the modes of phenomena are all the same. The varieties of phenomena are all diverse, are all different. So everything's of one taste and emptiness, but yet they all have ways of manifesting that are incredibly diverse. Okay? So again, that's just, you know, something that's addressing this whole idea of, you know, the various things that are produced, whether they're with or without minds. Now let's read 13AB. Nowhere is there a single condition that is able to give rise to all. So this is just, again, kind of completing that thought around how phenomena arise. They don't arise from some sort of single condition. They arise from a diverse number of conditions. As I was saying, you know, there's no one seed that gives rise to all apples, pears, peaches, plums, everything. You know, they all arise from their own unique causes and conditions. So the commentary, this is, various causes are needed to give rise to various results, because nowhere is there a single condition that is able to give rise to all results. So this is, in a way, a sort of a subtle refutation, too, of this idea that's in some of the non-Buddhist schools of this, like, fundamental nature that is in the Samkhya school, that they hold that there's this essence that all things arise from. The general principle, you know. There's also, of course, in some of the theistic traditions, this idea that all things arise from a creator God, you know, that some creator being gives rise to all these things, that all phenomena have their source in some being who's omnipotent and what have you. And again, this is not something that Buddhism holds. Buddhism is very logical and says, you know, based on what I observe, that's not the case. an apple tree comes into existence because of all the causes and conditions that are behind it, including the apple seed, which comes from another apple tree, which, you know, and so on. You see this whole chain of causes and conditions. And this various causes are necessary to give rise to various results. And they're all incredibly diverse. The diversity of phenomena is embraced in the view of emptiness. It's not denied. Now, this next section kind of goes as a lead-in, really, to what this objection is from the Sutra school proponents that we're going to get to. What it says here in on page 224, right after that bit that I just read, it says, let me find it on the page here, yeah, towards the bottom, the middle way proponents assert that ultimately there is no birth, aging, and so forth, that emptiness of inherent existence is natural nirvana, and that birth, aging, and so forth established through the force of karma and afflictions are samsara. So there's three ideas there that are kind of going to cause this response from this Sutra school proponent. So let's look at those three ideas. One is, ultimately there's no birth, aging, and death, and so on. Ultimately there are no phenomena, because when we ultimately analyze, we don't find those phenomena, we find their lack of inherent existence, their emptiness. Again, that's an ultimate mode of analysis. Conventionally, we embrace their diversity and that they exist as conventionalities. But when we ultimately analyze, no forms, no feelings, no discriminations, no compositional factors, you know, and so on, no eyes, no ears, no noses, no tongues, no bodies, we never find the phenomena that we're looking for when we ultimately analyze. The second idea is the emptiness of inherent existence is called natural nirvana, meaning that all things are in the nature of being empty of inherent existence. Our realization of them being empty of inherent existence doesn't make them empty of inherent existence. They already are, by their nature, empty of inherent existence. We misconceive this pencil to be inherently existent. By its nature, it is empty, and that's what we call natural nirvana, that there is this natural emptiness that pervades all phenomena. So there's this phrase that is used, it's natural nirvana. We're not talking about it being a real nirvana. Nirvana in this school is often used to refer to the state of liberation from the cycle of existence. It's achieved through practicing the path. But there is a phrase that is used, it's natural nirvana, meaning the natural lack of inherent existence of all phenomena. That this is their mode of, their ultimate mode of existence.
Repeat that one sentence again.
Sure.
What and what is natural nirvana? The absence of,
the absence of inherent existence of all phenomena is what we call natural nirvana. So things are by their nature lacking inherent existence. Doesn't mean that things are by their nature in the state of nirvana. I mean that we are by our nature in the state of nirvana. You know, that would be a very different thought. So we're going to get into some confusion about this because of this position that we hold, that we call it natural nirvana. It's only nominally nirvana, it's not really nirvana. But anyway, we'll get to that when we get to this argument. Was there another question? Barbara?
Is that the same as ultimate reality?
Ultimate reality? I mean, there is no ultimate reality, ultimate existence. Maybe the final nature of things, ultimate nature of things. Oh, this gets to be a hard one.
Well,
again, there's
ultimate,
there is ultimate truth.
That's what I meant. Ultimate,
yeah.
Truth.
Yeah. So I think there's nothing that ultimately exists, and yet there is an ultimate truth that things lacked inherent existence.
That's what I mean.
Yeah.
Can you say that natural nirvana is the same as
ultimate truth? I think so. Yeah.
Similar.
Yeah.
Emptiness, yeah.
The emptiness of all phenomena, of inherent existence of all phenomena. Yeah.
Who started calling it natural nirvana?
Who started?
I really couldn't tell you. It's really confusing because nirvana is something you think of as attained nirvana.
Right.
Yeah.
And this natural nirvana is very different. You know, I'm assuming the Buddha did. I'm assuming in one of the teachings of the Buddha that he calls this natural nirvana. I know that when I studied Maitreya's Abhisamayalamkara, that they use that in the explanation of nirvana, calling it natural nirvana. I couldn't tell you for sure.
You're going to go into
the difference between natural mm-hmm. bias mm-hmm. and non-zoning stuff.
Yeah, that comes up with this next bit. So let's read together the last two lines of 13. So these are at the top. Now we're at the top of page 223. And then the first two lines of 14. If ultimate is nirvana and samsara is conventional, in that case, since even a Buddha would be circling, what use would bodhisattva conduct be? So this is the argument that somebody is putting forward. Now, why it's a sutra school proponent, you got me. I mean, I have no idea. It could probably be a lot of people that are objecting to this. They hear this, just what I just explained, that this is natural nirvana. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't even finish that last little bit. There was a third idea, which is birth, aging, and so forth established through the force of karma and afflictions are samsara. So this is just, you know, holding that samsara is that conditioned existence of birth, aging, and death, and so on, conditioned by karma and afflictions. Albeit just nominal or illusory, it still is what we call samsara. But we do call the lack of inherent existence of things natural nirvana. So this person is getting it quite mixed up, which you may already be doing as well. But he's saying, if it is ultimate or natural nirvana, so if you're telling me that this lack of inherent existence is, you know, natural nirvana, then it's nirvana. You know? You can't call it nirvana and say it isn't nirvana. If it's natural nirvana, it's nirvana. But this person is saying that's equivalent then to attained nirvana, the nirvana that we achieve through practicing the path, the state of liberation, of cessation of suffering, and so on. So then he goes on to say, samsara is being empty of inherent existence is ultimate nirvana then. So he's saying, you know, and we would all agree that the samsara is being empty of inherent existence is natural nirvana, but it is not attained nirvana. And then he says, but samsara is circling by way of the continuity of birth and death conventionally, whereby it absurdly follows there is a common locus, meaning some common ground between samsara and nirvana. Because samsara is being empty of inherent existence is natural nirvana, so it's a nirvana, but samsara, the cycling from through life after life, is samsara. So we've got samsara and nirvana coexisting. You know, and again, this is not saying that attained nirvana and samsara coexist, but that natural nirvana and samsara exist. This is the distinction. But this person is confusing them and saying attained nirvana and samsara are coexisting. Therefore, there's a consequence that even a Buddha would be circling in samsara. Why? Because a Buddha's attained nirvana, but nirvana is within samsara because the emptiness of inherent existence of samsara is nirvana. So the bodhisattva conduct of the bodhisattvas for the sake of attaining Buddhahood is of no use. Kind of like saying no matter what you do, if this is nirvana, if the emptiness of samsara is nirvana, then samsara is nirvana. There's no getting out of it. Big confusion. I mean, again, I can't say that, you know, any of us might have this confusion, but somebody obviously did. Oftentimes we talk about three types of nirvana, just so you know. There is natural nirvana, and then there's two types of attained nirvana, which we've talked about before. Nirvana with remainder and without remainder. And the various schools, when we looked at, you know, the tenet systems, had ways of defining that. What does it mean to be with remainder or without remainder? In some of the lower schools, it was if after you achieve a state of liberation through practicing the path, attain nirvana, like if Ajna practiced the path, in this lifetime he attained nirvana, while he still has the body that he had before he attained it, he would be with remainder. After he dies, leaves that body behind, then he's without remainder. But that state of nirvana is still there. It's an attained nirvana that he's achieved through accomplishing the attainments of the path, and it's just whether he's with the aggregates or not, the contaminated aggregates, you know, the body. We get to the higher schools, again, they defined it quite differently, and I don't want to go in that direction, but just so you know, there are different ways of talking about nirvana. Let's read the reply, the last bit of this section. So the rest of 14 and then the first two of 15. If the conditions are not severed, also illusions are not averted. Since the conditions are severed, there is no arisal even conventionally. Does anyone want to comment on it?
Once the continuum of samsara is cut, samsara doesn't appear even conventionally.
Good. So this response, basically, we'll go ahead and go through what the commentary says. There is no fault. Why? Because there's this difference between natural nirvana and the nirvana that is the purity of adventitious stains, and not the nirvana that's attained through practicing the path that removes all of these stains, these adventitious stains. Natural nirvana does not rely upon familiarization on the path. Okay? So to distinguish these two further, natural nirvana is the natural emptiness of all these things, of me, of, you know, air, of space, of the earth, of all beings. It doesn't rely on familiarization with the path. It already is empty of inherent existence. It's the dharmata of all, regardless of the presence or absence of familiarization on the path. Their nirvana, that is a separation from adventitious stains, must be attained through severing the circling and samsara by way of the continuity of birth and death. So this other nirvana, that is the attainment of this state of cessation of cycling, has to be, you have to get familiar with the path. You have to practice the path in order to do that. So then, as Janice was saying, you know, although all of this lacks inherent existence, although there is natural nirvana, samsara is naturally empty of inherent existence, if the continuity of the conditions is not severed, not only samsara, but also the illusions, the illusory phenomena, are not averted. The illusions of things existing in a different way than they actually do, or than they appear. Again, things existing in a different way than they appear. This is the illusion. If the conditions such as ignorance are severed, then there's no samsara, even conventionally. So if you do attain this natural, or this attained state of nirvana, then you've severed the roots of cyclic existence. Samsara won't appear conventionally. But if samsara will continue to appear conventionally as long as you haven't realized that things are empty of inherent existence. The conditions for it to arise are there, it will continue to arise. If not, it's gone, it's done. So there is meaning to practicing the path. This proponent of the Sutra school was wrong in his or her assumption that, you know, if things are naturally empty of inherent existence, then there's no point in practicing the path because samsara is nirvana, there's some common locus, and so on. This is not a correct assumption. This last little bit is kind of a curious little thing. One must respond to the debate above through differentiating between ultimate nirvana and nirvana, not with something else, because the opponent accepts that a Buddha does not circle in samsara, whereas sentient beings do. I'm not really sure what the something else would be. These are usually added to kind of make sure that, you know, you understand why you would refute somebody with that particular reason than refuting them with some other reason. But there is a something else that my teacher didn't go into, and I couldn't find it in any commentaries, but the idea is that this is how you would refute it in this case, is by distinguishing between these two types of nirvana. Don't go anywhere else with any other arguments. Just say, you know, Sutra school opponent, you're wrong. This natural nirvana is not an attained nirvana. They're two different things. So any questions on this whole section? I realize this was a lot already tonight. Kind of to get through. This whole thing, again, was called the general refutation of these proponents of truly existent things. So this is kind of like putting them all together, even though we did have that one Sutra school proponent, but kind of saying, in general, anyone who's adhering to things existing inherently or truly is going to have these types of issues, is going to say, you know what? If you say it doesn't inherently exist, it doesn't exist, and therefore I've got a problem. You know, I've got all these various consequences that I think result from you telling me that this is how things exist, that they lack any inherent existence. So now we're going to move into actually a more specific refutation of the mind-only proponents. So to some degree, this involves refreshing our memory about mind-only, about what the mind-only school is holding. And we'll get to that as we go through this. I don't want to spend too much time on that now. The mind-only school actually starts off in a very similar vein, though, by still equating non-inherent existence with non-existence. For whatever reason, that seems to be the thing that's hardest for these people to get past. Let's go ahead and read... I need to go through this section. Okay, let's do that first. So on page 226 at the bottom there, where it says mind-only proponent, that first paragraph, that is verse 15 CD, where it says middle way proponent at the bottom of 226, that's 16 AB. On page 227, where it says mind-only proponent, that's 16 CD. Where it says middle way proponent, just a little bit below it, if mind itself appears, and so on, that whole paragraph is verses 17 and 18 AB. So it starts off with 17, and then it goes through the rest of it as you go through that whole paragraph.
Where's 16 CD?
16 CD is where it says mind-only proponent, even if the objects that are just as they appear at the top of 227. Then that next part again is 17 and 18 AB. The refutation of the analogy of the butter lamp and so on, that first part is where it says mind-only proponent is 18 CD. The middle way proponent is 19 AB, where it says the analogy is not established. So some of these, even though they look like it's one section, there's actually two bits that are being, you know, applied there. The next part that...
17, I'm sorry, where's 17 CD?
17, and the whole verse of 17 and 18 AB are up above, where it says mind middle way proponent, if mind itself appears as an illusory object. So when we get to the middle of the page where it says the refutation of the analogy of the butter lamp, the mind-only proponent piece is 18 CD. And then the next one where it says middle way proponent is 19 AB. I really apologize if this wasn't done as part of putting this text together, but the next part where it says the refutation of the analogy of glass, the mind-only proponent piece is two bits. It's 19 CD and 20 AB. The middle way proponent, which is a little bit down from there, about six lines down, where it says it follows at the analogy of the blueness and so on, that's 20 CD. Then, although a butter lamp does not illuminate itself, we're still on 227, I'm sorry. I was turning a page because I'm back on another set of commentary, but where it says, although a butter lamp does not illuminate itself, da-da-da-da, that whole paragraph is two verses, 21 and 22. Then we turn to the top of page 228, where it says, mind-only proponent, which goes on for several lines, that's 23 AB. Then where it says middle way proponent, remembering the object possessor and so on, that is 23 CD. That actually continues that whole, those little smaller paragraphs where it says the injection of the poison, da-da-da-da, up till where it gets this to, actually even through that next paragraph, I'm sorry. Go all the way down to where it says the refutation of another reasoning proving self-cognizers. The mind-only piece is 24 AB. The middle way proponent, which is just below it on the bottom of 228, is 24 CD. So again, sometimes there's more verses or more paragraphs that explain it further. So actually even at the top of page 229, this paragraph that says alternately and so on is a continuation of that thought. The next verse is where it says mind-only proponent. However, if there is no self-cognizer, this is verse 25, and actually that includes the middle way piece as well. So verse 25 has both of those in it, and I didn't break it out into 25 A, B, and C, D. I don't know. I'm not even sure that it is. Actually, 25 is really the reply. The mind-only proponent is implicit, so... Now we go all the way to the next page. The very top where it says mind-only proponent. Since there are no external objects, that's 26AB. Is everybody okay with doing this? It'll help you if you do study this like before the next class, because then you'll at least know where you can kind of look at these verses. Where it says middle way proponent, if forms and so forth are truly existent, that's 26CD. Is everybody there? Got that? No? Okay, so we're at the top of page 230. That first little bit on mind-only proponent was 26AB. About four lines down is where it says middle way proponent. That's 26CD. Then the very next paragraph where it says just as illusions, that's 27AB. Then there's a break and it says mind-only proponent, falsities and imputed existence and so on. That's 27CD. And then, actually that continues even with the middle way response. So then you go to the next break, there's a break and it says middle way proponent, if falsities, non-things, such as cyclic existence, da-da-da-da-da, that's 28AB. Then the paragraph that says by way of your system, mind-only proponents, that's two bits, it's 28CD and 29AB. And that very last paragraph at the bottom of 230 where it says, if asserted so, what excellence, da-da-da-da-da, that's 29CD. That concludes this section. Wow. Okay, now, if we have a few minutes, let's go back and see if we can start this a little bit. So on page 225, let's read together just these first two lines, 15CD. Mind-only proponent, if even a mistaken consciousness does not exist, then what will observe the illusion? Okay, so mind-only school is very similar to the middle way school in that they hold that there's an illusion going on. Things are appearing to exist in a way different than they do. However, their illusion doesn't entail the lack of inherent existence. Their illusion entails what? What do people recall from their study of mind only?
That things are aspects of your own mind, the nature of your own mind.
So in a sense, what they're saying is when we see an external object like this, you know, wonderful orchid here, this orchid is appearing due to the force of arising from the same substance as the consciousness knowing that orchid. So my eye consciousness at seeing that orchid and the orchid itself are said to be arising from the same substance. They say that basically there are karmic seeds that ripen into the experience of object and subject, but the object part of it is an illusion. It appears to be something external out here apart from my mind, when in reality it's arising from the same substance as my mind. Not that this is mind, but that it's arising from the same substance as mine. It's a very, very fine distinction, but and very hard to get your head around what they mean. Now what they're saying is, okay, you have an illusion too, middle way school, but if I try to get your illusion, you say that all these things lack inherent existence. It doesn't have anything to do with this being the same substance as the consciousness knowing it. Instead, it's that this doesn't have any inherent existence. Well, according to what I think about that, because, again, all these schools, mind only included, say inherent existence has to exist, or phenomena don't exist. Things have to exist inherently by way of their own nature, or we can't even talk about them existing. So if I say that, then it not only refutes the existence of that as inherent, an inherently existent orchid, it also refutes my consciousness. It also refutes the idea that my consciousness exists. So they are basically saying, if it doesn't inherently exist, it doesn't exist. Therefore, where's the mind that's seeing the illusion? You know, where? Who? What are you talking about? A consciousness having an appearance of an illusion and you know, illusory phenomena. That mind can't exist if things don't inherently exist. Because you are negating the inherent existence of the mind, and therefore are negating the existence of the mind. According to Chittamatra, according to mind only, they're saying, you know, this is the consequence that your view, Prasangika, Madhyamika, you holding this means that there's no mind to observe an illusion then, because if it doesn't inherently exist, it can't exist. Let's read the response, 16AB. So again, this is on 225. If the illusion itself does not exist for you, then what is observed at that time? So they're kind of using logic to throw a consequence back at them, kind of saying, well, you know, you're telling me this, but according to your logic, if that's what you're saying, then I'm going to poke holes in what you think, okay? So let's read what it says here. This is a little tricky, but there's an essence to it, I think, that is really quite clear. So this is a dispute, according to what Chantideva says, this is Drukpa Gyaltsen, in which one thinks that if this even exists, then it must exist inherently. If this doesn't exist inherently, then it doesn't exist. Equating inherent existence and existence. This is what this dispute is about. So first, if the appearance of the apprehended object as an external object is established just as it appears. So they're kind of flying things in the face of Chittamatra. So again, Chittamatra is saying these external objects, this external orchid, according to mind only, doesn't exist in the way that it appears as an external object. But Prasangika is just playing devil's advocate. They're saying, well, if it does exist in the way that it appears, then, you know, since external objects do exist as external objects, the illusory and the observer of that will not exist. So what you're saying as illusory can't possibly exist. So they're kind of basically first starting off by saying, you know, if I'm right, take for granted that Prasangika is right, Madhyamika is right, and this does exist as an external object, then your whole theory, Chittamatra, is thrown out the window. I mean, we can just forget about it because there's no illusion going on at all. You know, because since it exists as an external object, well, then there's no illusion, and, you know, there's nothing going on. Chittamatra can't hold to any other illusion, any other observer of an illusion. On the other hand, if it is not established just as it appears, which is what Chittamatra would hold. They say, okay, this out here is not established in the way that it appears. It appears to be an external object, but it's not truly an external object. It's an object that's arising from the same substance of the mind. So in that way, it does not exist in the way that it appears. Then, since it also would lack inherent existence, according to Prasangika, you can't say that this doesn't have some external existence and doesn't exist in the way that it appears, and it still have inherent existence. They really see a fallacy in two things. I mean, we're going to get to this throughout this argument. Prasangika looks at Chittamatra and says, one, you're negating that external objects exist as external objects. You're saying that these, what appears to be an external object is really arising from the same substance as consciousness. Uh-uh. There are external objects. Yeah, our consciousness is definitely interrelated with them. But there are external objects. There are objects that are external to the consciousness. Two, you're holding that consciousness in particular. You're holding quite strongly to consciousness as inherently existent. And both of these are absolutely wrong. External objects do exist, and consciousness does not inherently exist. So they're going to basically keep throughout this trying to poke holes in Chidamatra's point of view and show the fallacy of this point of view. So this first way is saying, we're just working with the idea of external objects. So we're saying, if this is true, that external objects do exist, then you don't even have an illusion going on. But if it is untrue, if they're not established in that way, it would follow that they would also lack inherent existence. Because they don't exist the way that they appear. There's no truth there to their appearance. And then, the consequence is, then according to you, it would be non-existent. Why? Because you just told me in your little argument in 15 CD that if it lacked an inherent existence, it doesn't exist. So therefore, what observed object is there of this illusion? If you hold that it doesn't exist as external, then it doesn't exist inherently. Therefore, it doesn't exist. Because you said if it doesn't exist inherently, it doesn't exist. They're throwing it back in the face of the Chidamatrans, because Chidamatrans are saying, if it doesn't inherently exist, it doesn't exist. Now, admittedly, probably what you're thinking is it sounds like Prasangika is putting words in Chidamatra's mouth to some extent, because they're saying it's equivalent to say that if it doesn't exist in the way that it appears, which Chidamatra would agree, but their appearance is that it appears as externally existent when it doesn't exist that way, then that's equivalent to saying that it doesn't exist inherently. I'm not so sure that a Chidamatran would agree to that. If we had one in the room, you know, would we say, and they were actually holding this view and had philosophically thought it out and studied it and what have you and meditated on it, they would say, no, I mean, I'm just negating that it has an external existence. I'm not negating that it has inherent existence. But according to Prasangika, you can't deny one and hold the other. And we're going to get more of this in these verses to come that will fill in the blanks a bit more so that we understand why negating an external existence would also negate its inherent existence.
That's a good point right there.
Now, in the end, we don't negate external existence in Prasangika. We're just kind of poking holes in the Chidamatra point of view, you know. So we're saying, Chidamatra, you know, when you negate external existence, there's no way you can still hold that there is inherent existence. You would have to be negating that as well. But you want to hold to inherent existence and negate external existence. It doesn't make any sense. Prasangika, though, this Madhyamika Prasangika point of view says, we're not going to negate external existence because we're quite happy saying that this book is an external object. No problem. It just doesn't have any inherent existence. It's empty of inherent existence. External existence, absolutely not a problem. So like I said, these two main points of Chidamatra that we talked about in the tenets studies are going to be the main things that Shantideva focuses on. They're the main things that Chandrakirti focuses on in his text, Supplement to the Middle Way. They're the main ways that we poke holes in the view of Chidamatra, that this is not the final view of the Buddha. Okay. Let's just read the last little bit of this, and then we'll quit for the evening. So, as I was saying, if it is not established just as it appears, then since it lacks inherent existence, according to you, it must be utterly non-existent. If even the illusion-like appearance as the apprehended object itself does not exist, then what apprehended object is observed at that time? You know, you're talking about an illusion to yourself, mind-only school, that when you look at an object, there's an illusion of it appearing to exist externally, and it doesn't. But through what I've just told you, you'd be negating its own existence. Because negating its external existence necessarily negates its inherent existence, which according to you negates its existence. So if there's a non-existent orchid, how are you observing it in an illusory way? How is it existing in an illusory way? How are you even observing a non-existent? Just, again, throwing consequences back at it. So you notice Shantideva never answers this, but rather throws a consequence back because he's recognizing, as it says here, that this is a dispute where you hold that if it doesn't exist inherently, it doesn't exist. Or if it exists, it exists inherently. So he's kind of acknowledging and recognizing that the problem is that mind only, like the schools below it as well, connect these two, inherent existence and existence. that's that last little bit of, like I was saying in the tenets class, of holding on to the log as we get out to the very depths of the lake. You know, we're willing to wade in, but we keep holding on to something to keep us afloat. It's that view of things exist, therefore they exist inherently. And the Prasangika Madhyamika wants to find that middle way that says you can let go of the log and you don't sink. You know, there's not a problem. It doesn't all fall apart. You don't drown. Okay. So if even it closes and says, even apprehenders of form, sounds, and so forth will not exist. So if you are continuing to adhere to this, basically everything that lacks inherent existence doesn't exist for you. There's no apprehendeds, there's no apprehenders. There's nothing that exists. You know, this is absurd, you know, you holding that these two are equivalent. And it really comes down to the mind-only proponent simply not knowing yet what this really means. You know, what does it really mean to lack inherent existence? They haven't discerned that view of emptiness yet. And if they correctly discern it, then they don't have a problem with establishing that things exist conventionally and yet lack inherent existence ultimately. Was that enough for the evening? Did I go over the top? Is it flowing over, spilling over the sides and landing on the floor and making puddles? And well, take your puddle with you. You know, you can. It'll settle. It'll go down. And you can put more in later. But well, you know, I have the feeling that we're probably not going to make it much beyond Chitamatra next week. So if you actually are a week behind in the reading, you're probably okay. So if you read up through verse 29, I do have the quizzes for up through 29, but I'm going to hold on to them because there's only really one bit that we've already covered, and I would rather not hand them out and confuse issues. If you don't have a copy of the quiz from last time that covers up through verse 15 AB, then let me know, and I have copies of that here. So no questions? Is everybody fried? Thank you for your patience, your perseverance, and I just really want to encourage you. I mean, I have to tell you myself, I was studying this, I told Paul, and I was mentioning it to someone else earlier, but I was studying this stuff yesterday, and it's really, really hard material, trust me. I mean, I'm having a difficult time getting my head around it. And I hope that I can impart some understanding of it from, you know, these other great masters who have explained it in the past. But, you know, if you're not getting it, be very patient with yourself, because, you know, it just takes time. You know, it really does. That's the only thing I can really say to give you some encouragement. And I would encourage you, even though you might feel frustrated and feel like, you know, when you walk out of here at the end of these classes that you didn't really get anything, at some level you are getting something. Yeah. So come back. Keep coming back. And what you'll find, I mean, what I really have some confidence in is that even as we go through the rest of Chapter 9, that it will fall into place to a greater degree, because some of these concepts will be coming up. As you saw when we went through the main outline of this chapter, we get into all the reasonings that establish the lack of inherent existence later on. Right now is just all this debate about what do you mean by that, and it contradicts with my ordinary view of the world or my view through these various tenet systems. So mind-only is going to, you know, be a problem. Other lower schools are going to be a problem. Even some of these non-Buddhist schools are going to, you know, pipe in and say, you know, I got a problem with your view. But then the actual view is going to be established, and at that point, so much more of this will fall into place, and you'll actually have the tools to be able to realize this yourself and to meditate on it, you know, quite extensively. Just so you know, we're timing the spring retreat, actually winter retreat. It's in February. It's towards the beginning of February, right around Losar at the Mandala Center again, to be a meditation on emptiness retreat. So it will be 3 days, starting on a Thursday night and going through Sunday lunch. So we'll have plenty of time to, you know, get into some analytical meditation on emptiness. I think it's February 7th through 10th. just so you know. There'll be more information coming on that. Okay? And certainly, yeah, I mean, all of you who are doing this kind of study would, you know, be prime candidates to join in on a retreat like that. But even people who just had the Discovering Buddhism course on emptiness, which will also be taught before that time, will, you know, certainly have enough to work with. Okay, let's do our dedication prayers. Tonight we'll go right to 246. On 246 and 247 are these verses from chapter 10 of Shantideva's Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. Maybe we can bring to mind, before we recite these verses, any specific beings that we want to dedicate the merit from this evening for, so that they can have good health or freedom from obstacles. They will have a good rebirth if they have died recently, and so on, or the strength and support that they need if they're engaging with challenges in their life, such as illness of friends and family or the death of loved ones, and so on. So we basically want to make this a very strong way of connecting with the suffering of others, and through the force of our dedication, create the causes for this merit to become the result of complete enlightenment for all these beings, the removal of all their problems, both temporally and ultimately. So with those beings in mind, whoever you are bringing to mind right now, we can recite these verses that are all about creating the causes for the temporal and ultimate happiness of all these beings. May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled, with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments, whatever diseases there are in the world. They never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid, and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power, and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. Turn back a page. On 244, we'll recite the long life prayers for His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Lama Zopa Rinpoche. So think that you're also dedicating this merit for the good health and long lives of these two very precious teachers, as well as for those teachers with whom you have a special karmic connection, wherever they might be, even if they have not yet manifested in your life, so that you might never be separated from them, nor from the precious Mahayana Dharma that they teach in this lifetime and all lifetimes until you attain the state of enlightenment. In the land encircled by snow mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. All-powerful Chenrezig Tenzin Gyatso, please remain until samsara ends. You who uphold the subduer's moral way, who serve as the bountiful bearer of all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Manjunath's victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplish magnificent prayers honoring the three jewels, Savior of myself and others, your disciples, please, please live long. And lastly, we can dedicate this merit for peace, peace in the hearts and minds of each and every sentient being throughout each and every realm. So just think that this merit creates this wave of peaceful thoughts and intentions that goes out in all directions, pacifying all beings. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
I really appreciate the opportunity to teach this, so I'm glad you all are willing subjects.